Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rob Young. On this edition, a political row over money in France has jolted financial markets. We look at why there's a standoff in Parliament over the budget and ask why the country's politicians have failed to tackle the nation's high level of borrowing. Also this half hour, the boss of the clothing giant Uniqlo on his quest to become the world's biggest garment retailer. And we'll head to the Arctic territory of Greenland, where the capital has finally got an airport.
It is not only an airport for me, it is also an airport for a modern Greenland.
We'd love to hear from you, of course. You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. The number you need is +44 330 678 3033. Well, we start in France, where a political standoff is causing financial market turbulence. France is currently borrowing double the amount it is allowed to under European Union rules. So the Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, who's only been in the job a few months, has proposed 60 billion euros. That's about 63 billion US dollars worth of spending cuts and tax rises. But there is nowhere near enough support in Parliament for the budget to pass. So markets are nervous that the budget will get watered down or will fail completely and the government will be brought down with it. The Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, warned this week of serious financial turbulence if that happens.
The moment is very serious. It is the national budget vote that is at stake, which affects the entire life of municipalities, the state, hospitals, and so many people. This is a moment filled with difficulties, but it's not a surprise for me because I will not go back to the conditions under which I was appointed just 2.5 months ago as Prime Minister. I accepted to be Prime Minister. The incredible debt of 3,228 billion euros, a record deficit, no majority in the National Assembly. This is the first time since 1958, with only 15 days to create the budget. Just 15 days. So I make this budget. It is not perfect. I know that. We need to modify and improve it.
Well, left-wing parties and the far-right National Rally have threatened to block the budget and bring the government down unless changes are made to the tax and spending plans. Marine Le Pen is the National Rally's leader.
It's a question of knowing whether we're going to succeed in changing a budget that is at the same time bad, unfair and violent towards the French people, and if not, to draw the political consequences.
Well, people in France, like in other countries, have had a tough few years as prices spiralled upwards. Businesses have found it difficult also. Political chaos this year, sparked by early elections and a divided parliament that then led to months of negotiations to form a government, have not helped firms. Pierre Lustric is the president of Santis, a company that makes fragrances in France. He spoke to me for Business Daily earlier this year.
It's a difficult equation, as you know, because the French debt is huge. And we are the limits of how much we can tax the people in France. We are one of the most taxed country in the world. So it's difficult to tap into the, you know, the pockets of the riches. So there are more ground in terms of savings. But as you might know, culturally, and in the last 30, 40 years, we have been a social country, one of the most generous, along with the Scandinavian countries. So there is this difficult equation, which at some point needs to be addressed. And there is certainly a lot of wait and see on that aspect.
Well, earlier today, the cost of French government borrowing rose to a level higher than that of Greece, a nation which endured a bruising financial crisis a few years ago and had to be bailed out by, among others, France. Well, that is an alarming moment for the world's seventh biggest economy, which is also a nuclear power and a key pillar of the European Union. I've been talking to Emmanuel Auriol, who's a professor at the Toulouse School of Economics and also sits on the Council of Economic Analysis, which advises the French government on economic affairs. She's been telling me why the country's public finances are in such a mess.
Well, France has been running debt forever. The last time we were at budget was like 50 years ago. And so, of course, with the COVID and also, I believe, some kind of mistake that was linked to the energy crisis. So we subsidize heavily energy in France, contrary to, let's say, Spain or Germany. And that's increased the debt of France significantly. And so now we are totally off track and the level of debt is really unsustainable.
Now, the government is trying to cut spending and raise taxes by 60 billion euros, 63 billion US dollars a year. And we've got politicians on both the political left and on the right saying they just hate the plans. Is there an alternative, do you think, cutting spending and raising more revenue?
No, I don't see any other alternative. We have to, first of all, cut spending, I believe, mainly because the level of taxation in France is very, very high, already one of the highest on earth. So we cannot really increase taxation, I think. It will be unbearable. So the only solution is to reduce spending, and we spend too much.
So you're saying, in a sense, there is no alternative. French people will just have to pay the same, maybe pay more in taxes, but get less back from the French state.
Exactly. So I think one thing that cost us a lot are social spending. France is one of the most generous countries on earth for that. And so we will have to cut at some point social contribution. So maybe reduce also the amount of money we give to pensioners, to retire people. So we have to make difficult decisions, I think.
Now, we've seen financial market investors push up the amount that they charge the French government to lend it money in recent days, briefly going past Greece's at one point today, which of course was in a terrible financial state a few years ago. Does that kind of move on the financial markets tend to focus political minds?
Well, unfortunately, we have a very bad political class, especially from extreme, so extreme right and extreme left. They seem totally irresponsible to me. They don't seem to realize that we are living on credit right now. And so raising the cost of our debt will be being instantaneously more poor. And so to have to borrow more. So this is really something we have to fix.
If we end up effectively with a battle between politicians on the one side and the bond market that is funding a large part of French public spending on the other, who is likely to win?
Well, I believe the bond market will win because we depend on our creditor, and there is no escape route from that. You know, if they lend us, it's because we have a lot of saving. France is a country where people save a lot. So in the worst case scenario, the debt will be reimbursed by confiscating saving from French people. It happened in the past in Italy, it happened in Greece, it happened in other places. So it's possible that this thing happened, but because of this huge amount of saving that exists in France, I think the lenders are relatively safe.
It is perfectly possible that the government collapses as a result of this row over the budget. What do you think that could mean for the finances and the amount that the government and also French companies are charged for borrowing money?
Unfortunately, the constitution is not designed to handle this type of situation. So it happened a bit in the past. So what we know in this case, if the government falls on the budget, what will happen is that there will have a continuation of budget. So the 1/12 of the budget of the last year budget will be reinstalled for just dealing with everyday matter and to pay the civil servant, the pensioner, etc., until we find a solution, so a new government and a new budget. I really hope we will avoid this situation because, of course, it's very bad for foreign direct investment. It's very bad for business. It's very bad for lenders. So I hope we will not be in this situation.
If the French people vote for parties that want to continue the current level of borrowing and of spending, shouldn't democracy win out in a sense? Shouldn't the politicians just say to financial market investors, this is what the French people want and we're going to carry on?
Well, they can say whatever they want, but if nobody wants to buy the French debt and the interest rate become 22% like it was in Greece, we are dead. Starting, let's say, on August, the French government is living on debt. So we need to borrow all the time. Every year we borrow more. Huh? And so we depend on our creditor, of course. We do.
Emmanuel Auriol there, professor at the Toulouse School of Economics and a member of the Council of Economic Analysis. Well, let's speak now to Susanna Streeter, head of money and markets at the UK brokers Hargreaves Lansdown. Hi, Susanna.
Hi there, Rob.
So what are markets making of all of this? I suppose not just in France, but also what is happening in Germany, where there are early elections because of a row over government borrowing there too?
Yeah, well, actually, if you look at the wider markets, so on equity markets, for example, the CAC 40 and the DAX are actually in positive territory, less moved by what's been happening. But if you look at the debt markets and you look at where yields are currently trading right now, there is still a bit of a bond investor strop out going on when it comes to French government bonds, although the yields have edged a little bit lower, that and they've recovered a little bit of poise after those yields really rose yesterday. They're still trading at a risk premium over German bonds. And as you mentioned a little bit earlier, of course, if you look at where they are in terms of Greek bonds, well, actually, borrowing costs are higher in France right now. And this does indicate that investors are pretty nervous about what is going to happen ahead, given there is so much fractious debate over this budget, and it may not pass. And if it doesn't, the worry will be that simply France's borrowing costs will shoot higher, and that's making bond investors particularly wary.
Susanna, thank you for now, but do stay with us. I want to come back to you in a moment to talk about this story we're going to go to now, which is regulators in the United States approving plans for the first 24-hour stock exchange. The 24 exchange, as it is called, will eventually offer round-the-clock trading. Well, joining us from Miami in Florida is the chief executive and founder of the company, Dmitry Galanov. Welcome to the program, Dmitry. Is there demand then for people to trade through the night?
Thank you. It's good to be here. Yes, absolutely. We see tremendous demand, especially from Asia-Pacific region.
And so this is about attracting companies to list on your exchange, is it?
No, the companies, typically they would list on New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, as they normally do now. However, if the company listed are on those exchanges, we can trade those companies around the clock.
Usually the way stock market trading works is that an individual trader would focus on a particular group of companies, a particular sector of the economy, and would trade those shares when the market is open during daylight hours. So how's it going to work when traders are asleep?
Well, I think for different people, it's, you know, right now the market is open 24 hours a day. The news are flowing 24 hours a day. And companies like Tesla and Microsoft, they have worldwide following. So essentially, when the investors are awake in Asia, they can trade Tesla and Microsoft during the hours that they awake. And when the investors are awake in US, they'll trade in their hours. So you have around-the-clock access to global investors.
So people, won't be afraid of missing out on a particular market move when they're asleep rather than staring at their screen trading?
Well, I mean, the people can put limit orders, so they can put a price for this in the system that they would like. And the exchange will keep that price. And if the stock reaches that price, it will trade the stock. So when you sleep, you can leave the limit order. And hopefully when you wake up, it might be executed.
So the exchange will do an element of automatic trading in on traders' behalf. Would you expect your emergence as a 24-hour exchange to lead to the more established stock exchanges that you mentioned, like in New York or the NASDAQ, the tech index in the US, or maybe the FTSE in London and other exchanges around the world, to perhaps change their trading hours also?
Absolutely. Actually, just a couple of weeks ago, New York Stock Exchange, they filed the application to expand their trading hours to 22 hours a day. So certainly our move, there's other exchanges that coming and into the same territory that we will provide the services. However, we are very, very excited about it because, you know, when you have us and you have New York Stock Exchange available overnight, you'll have more liquidity for the traders to execute their orders.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dmitry Galanov there, the chief executive and founder of 24 Exchange. Let's go back to Susanna Streeter now, the head of money and markets at Hargreaves Lansdown in the UK. What do you make of that, Susanna? Do you think there is a large appetite among traders to trade in the middle of the night?
Well, certainly the demand for continuous trading has surged in recent years, particularly, of course, with the rise of speculators on cryptocurrency markets. And also during the pandemic, there was accelerated growth in off-exchange overnight trading. So you've got platforms like Robinhood and others enabling users to trade US stocks beyond traditional hours. And it's interesting that, of course, that the New York Stock Exchange has recently filed this application to extend its trading hours to 22 hours daily. So I think it is the direction of travel, certainly, because non-stop trading does allow investors to respond very quickly to market moving news outside all those standard hours. But there was a mention there about increased liquidity. Still, I think that there will be reduced trading volumes during off hours, even if more exchanges get in on the act, which could result in less accurate pricing. So there is a downside.
Thanks very much indeed, Susanna Streeter there from Hargreaves Lansdown. You can contact us on that or any of the other stories you're hearing on the programme today, or send us a voice note to the number you need. It's +44 330 678 3033. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. We're going to hear now from one of the world's most influential bosses. Tadashi Yanai may not be a household name around the world, but is the chief executive of Fast Retailing, the company behind the global fashion chain Uniqlo. That Japanese firm is the world's third biggest clothes retailer and has been expanding aggressively in Europe and in the United States. Asia is still its biggest market, and Uniqlo has now more stores in China than in its home country, Japan. The BBC's Mariko Oi has been talking to Tadashi Yanai.
Uniqlo is the world's third biggest fashion retailer, known for its affordable casual clothing. The first store was opened in Japan 40 years ago, and it's expanded rapidly in Asia and now in Europe and North America. Today, there are almost 2,500 stores around the world. Its success has made the boss of its parent company, Tadashi Yanai, Japan's richest man. But the 75-year-old has an ambitious target of overtaking Zara parent Inditex to become the world's biggest fashion retailer. I recently caught up with him in Tokyo and asked if he thinks he can achieve that before he retires.
I like to achieve it, and I believe I need to achieve it. In order to do that, we need to imagine how different a 10 trillion yen firm is from a 3 trillion yen firm and recreate our company every day. We want to change people's perception about clothing, that it can continue to evolve.
I want to ask your views on today's fast fashion industry, especially Chinese retailers like Shein and Temu. What do you think is the future of this industry?
I don't think there's a future for fast fashion. They're producing clothes without any careful considerations, which you can only wear for one season. That is a waste of the planet's resources. You can wear Uniqlo clothes for many seasons, the shirt or the sweater that I'm wearing today. I have no idea how old they are.
I want to ask you about China, because its economic challenges have been affecting your performance there as well. What's your strategy there? Do you think you're going to need to change your strategy or outlook there?
I don't think we need to revise our strategy for China. There are 1.4 billion people, and we only have 900 to 1,000 stores. I think we can increase that to 3,000 stores.
I want to ask you about supply chains, because Uniqlo has been trying to build supply chains that customers can trust, where there's transparency about the environmental impact and human rights. Is this because of a controversy over whether Uniqlo uses cotton from Xinjiang? You didn't confirm nor deny that back in 2021. Can you clarify if there's any cotton from Xinjiang in Uniqlo products?
No, we're not using cotton from Xinjiang. You know, by mentioning which cotton we're using. Actually, it gets too political if I say any more. So let's stop here.
That was the Fast Retailing Chief Executive Tadashi Yanai there talking to Mariko Oi. Let's head to Greenland now, which is officially part of Denmark. It's an island between the Atlantic and Arctic Oceans. And a new international airport has opened its runways today in Greenland's capital Nuuk, allowing larger aircraft to land for the first time. The development paves the way for direct flights from the United States and Europe. Well, the first flight touched down just over an hour ago, and it's the first of three airport projects that officials hope will boost the local economy by making the Arctic territory more accessible than ever before. Adrienne Murray has been to have a look.
Rock has been blasted and tarmac laid to get this longer runway ready. And the finishing touches have been put to a brand new terminal. Until now, only small propeller planes could land in the biggest city. But from Thursday, that will change.
Much larger aircraft will be able to arrive here in Nuuk, and that will pave the way for new connections to Greenland's capital.
Many locals welcome the change.
It is not only an airport for me, it is also an airport for a modern Greenland.
Lately we have been shut from the whole world, and now we're going to open for the world.
Only 4 hours' flight from either Europe or East Coast USA, Nuuk will become Greenland's travel hub. Inside an Air Greenland hangar, I spoke to the airline's CEO, Jakob Nitter Sorensen.
It's going to shorten the travel time and it's going to decrease the cost of producing the flight. So hopefully that will have a positive impact on the ticket prices. That will have a positive impact on demand as well.
From June, SAS will also fly from Copenhagen and United will launch twice-weekly flights direct from New York. Greenland is a vast territory with a population of just 57,000 people. But until now, a remote runway built by the Americans during World War II has been the main entry point. Travellers then have to transit to their destination in small turboprop planes. And that's often been time-consuming, young Greenlander Isaac Finn tells me.
First have to fly over there, and then you have to wait, and then there's like bad weather or not enough planes, and then you get stuck there. It's annoying.
After Nuuk, two more new airports will open in 2026 as part of a plan to boost the economy. More than $800 million has been spent. Jens Lauritsen is the CEO of Greenland Airports.
It will be the key to opening up Greenland to make it easy accessible from Europe or North America. Once you make a country that has been quite difficult to get to and you create an easy access like this, I'm sure we will see a lot of tourism, we will see a lot of change.
This new infrastructure is meant to be a shot in the arm for Greenland's economy, but its impact could be far-reaching. Naya Nathanielsen is Greenland's business minister.
It's going to be absolutely profound effect on society, not only for the population, but also for the business sector. I also sense that it's going to really change the map of Greenland. That will bring with it a lot of good, but also some changes we will probably need to adjust into.
And this once hard-to-reach Arctic territory is being brought closer to Europe and North America than ever before.
Adrienne Murray there, reporting from Nuuk, the capital of Greenland. Now, in Ghana, in West Africa, the Mortuary Workers Association has started a nationwide strike, plunging mortuary services across the country into disarray. The industrial action follows a prolonged row over working conditions, including the supply of personal protective equipment, as well as pay. Richard Coffey-Jordan is the General Secretary of the Mortuary Workers Association of Ghana. He told me more about why they've gone on strike.
I don't think it's our intention to just punish any family member or the Guinean people. We have had these issues of PPEs for a very long time. Over 4 years, we've been battling our personal equipment to be used at the various facilities. We've had some salary arrears that dated back 2021 and other coronavirus bonuses that the president promised to pay us also dated back 2021. We've reminded governments or the employer of the need to settle these outstanding issues for a very long time. Somewhere in September, we issued similar threats. Government came apologizing and also plead for more time. We have given them time. Between 10th October to date, we reminded government with a letter officially to the Minister of Health indicating that if nothing is done for our issue, we shall back on similar strike today.
The Ministry of Health, though, as I understand it, has said that it will try to ensure that there is, for example, the immediate provision of PPE, personal protective equipment, and also the Labour Department is looking at mortuaries, inspecting them to make sure that the places where your members work follow all of the rules. Are you happy that there is progress on some of your demands?
We're not happy. That is why we have actually embarked on this strike. During the last strike on September 26, the Fair Wages and Salaries Commission directed the Labor Department, together with the Mortuaries and Funeral Facilities Agency, to do a labor inspection to determine what and what is needed for effective operation of our mortuaries. Unfortunately, that has not been done. Where we are now, our members are just dying every day.
It is an important role for many families at one of the toughest moments of their lives when a loved one passes away. And this strike action will affect funerals. It will mean that the bodies of the dead remain uncollected. How do you feel about that?
Very sad. I'm a very unhappy person now. I feel that we are passing through a very dangerous time in our lives. It is not fair that somebody will lose a loved one and then he's done all the obituaries, everything is done, prepared, and then he's coming for his loved one. You are told that you cannot take somebody who you have done every arrangement for. It's a very bad situation. But sincerely, our members are also grieving, and it is time that we ask the government to also sympathize with the Ghanaian public and provide the PPEs.
Do you know how many funerals have had to be cancelled as a result of the strike?
We should have over 2,000, 3,000 funerals across the country, even more. And so it's really a hectic time for all of us as Ghanaian people.
So if you aren't satisfied with what the government says or does today, then what happens tomorrow?
The strike continues unabated. We have had sympathy on the Ghanaian public for a very long time, but our sympathy is being taken for granted. The government is seeing our sympathy, our leniency to be a witness, and therefore our issues are not resolved as timely as it demands.
Richard Coffey Jordan there, which brings us to the end of this edition of World Business Report.